picked up by almost every recent book on Song of Songs, is that there is a very positive view to human sexuality and to this relationship between the lover and the beloved, or as the ESV imaginatively calls them, he and she. But it is important that we qualify that a little bit, because Solomon's ideal couple, they're not strangers, you know, they don't just kind of spot each other and then kind of end up in bed as soon as they can untie their shoelaces. This book is kind of sexual, but it speaks about sex in a very interesting way. The first thing is that all the discussion takes place as part of within the context of the romance, love, exclusive commitment, cherishing, selfless love kind of nexus. There's nothing about the book that suggests it's like a detailed sex manual. And I think one or two of the commentaries and one or two speakers in recent years have focused on that. I think they're actually missing the point of the book. The relationship is only going one place, which is made obvious, as we'll see in a minute, in chapter 3 and also the conclusion of the book. But it's not about sex per se, nor is it about marriage, although that sort of exclusive commitment is the atmosphere in which the book exists. It's really about love. But I think it's important to highlight this. The way in which the book speaks about love and sex is quite interesting. The first thing to notice is that not all the language is sexual or even sexy or erotic. There is much in here which is delicately and gently suggestive, but there's lots which isn't, which is just purely affectionate. There's the fact, for example, that the lover keeps calling his beloved sister. You see that in chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, 5, 1 and 2, which is obviously a relational intimacy. The second thing is that the refrain of the book consciously restricts sex to the context of a committed, permanent, monogamous relationship. You see that in chapter 2, verse 7, and again in 3, 5, and again in the conclusion in 8, verse 4. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Now, a lot of ink's been spilled on that one, but I think the meaning is actually fairly clear. Make sure that you get things the right way round. Until there's been a conscious decision, until there's a real concrete irreversible commitment, then don't muck around with sexual attraction. See, Song of Songs just cannot be reduced to attract for the free love movement. And then thirdly, there's the slightly troublesome fact for those who want to read the book as a sex manual that it isn't actually clear that the couple have sex at any point. The closest they come seems to be in chapter 7, verses 11 to 14, where we read this. Come, my lover, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my lover. It's heady stuff. Can't deny that, but there is at least the possibility that when they make it to their secluded spot out in the villages, wherever it is, she says, I'm really sorry, we have to wait for the pomegranates. You've got to add to that much of the book is made up of dreams. So it isn't always clear what's actually happening and what is part of the delicious anticipation of their union. So in, for example, chapter 5, in the same way that the watchmen probably didn't actually beat her in 5 verse 7, because she's dreaming, according to 5 verse 1, all the way through the book, we always have to at least admit the possibility that what the lover and the beloved are talking about is anticipation rather than what's actually happening. Okay? Then add to that the fact the book is full of images that are clearly enticing and vaguely erotic, but can't be tied down. For example, 2 verse 3, his fruit is sweet to my lips. For example, Mark Driscoll gives a very precise interpretation of that, but I think it's actually much simpler to say that the beloved likes the thought of kissing her lover, that he tastes good. And to press these metaphors any further is actually to read into the text rather than to work out what it says. So 4 verse 13, for example, your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruit, with henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes. And you're not making this very easy. That was just slipping the tongue. And then incense tree with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You're a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. It's not that he is referring to parts of her body as plants. It's a general picture, not a specific one. Similarly, in chapter 5, verses 1 to 3, I've come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I've gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. This isn't a list of kind of euphemisms for orgasms or anything else. These are all just pictures of satisfaction in which a lot is left to the imagination. These are delicate, vague, suggestive, and enticing rather than explicit. That's why it's hard to work out, to tie them down, because they're not supposed to be. And I think for me the telling thing is the way in which the book ends. It doesn't depict the lovers in bed. They just disappear off arm in arm into the sunset. You see, that's why I think it really is a mistake to press this book into service as saying anything about sex. The metaphors are too slippery, and I think deliberately so. You may or may not find this helpful, but I think at points it's more like Monty Python's nudge, nudge, wink, wink sketch, which if you've ever seen it, the whole point of the sketch is it's talking about, you know, sex. But you can't work out what the specific language is. It starts off with, do you like photography? And the whole point is, well, you know, you can't work out what it is. It's just the guy is talking in a sexual way. That's the way the book works. It's immensely sexual, but it's not explicit. It's daring and suggestive and enticing and provocative, but it's not supposed to be raunchy. Has anyone ever seen the film Brief Encounter? Anybody ever seen Brief Encounter? It was made in 1945. It's one of the classics of cinema. Starred a bloke called Trevor Howard and Celia Johnson. And in a sense, not much happens in the film. Being 1945, there are no romps between the sheets, no swearing, nor any kind of sexual innuendo. So why is it counted as a classic? Why do people still watch it? If you Google it when you get home, you'll still be able to get it. Because the film manages to capture the compelling attraction between two people without an inch of naked flesh even being shown. I think there may be one point where there is a glimpse of Celia Johnson's ankle through her stockings, but that's as steamy as it gets. And yet, if you watch it, it's actually a very erotic, I suppose, film. It's quite compelling. And that's what the Song of Songs is like, with one difference. That's about a brief encounter that may or may not turn into an affair that this couple are committed to each other. Okay? And one of the countercultural things about Song of Songs is the constant powerful suggestion that real passion and unbridled sexual attraction is actually to be found in a committed relationship. There is Solomon, you know, with his 700 wives, 300 concubines, kind of constantly adding to his harem. And he sees this ordinary couple who are radically committed to each other. And Solomon's saying, the best sex is found with the one that you love. So in this book, he strikes this delicate balance between provocative language, but language that's never explicit. He manages neither to be prudish nor pornographic. He paints an immensely positive picture of sex without ever devaluing it or cheapening it. Okay. So what we have in this book is an incredibly positive view of the relationship between a man and a woman in the broad context of marriage, and a critique of his own lifestyle. Okay? Now let me just take a minute to show you how he does this as the book unfolds. One of the things that makes this book hard to read is it's not entirely clear who's speaking at what point. And that is just the challenge. Okay? Now, we don't even know if these two people are actually real people or characters in a story or representative figures. We just don't know. We don't know whether Solomon pursued this woman and saw that she was actually radically committed to this individual. Or we're not sure if just through his own experience of rejection and reflecting on the choices that he'd made, Solomon then decided to write this book and to fill out this real person and to to fill out her world imaginatively. It doesn't say. You know, we just don't know. But what we do know is that the way in which this relationship is described from the point, from the perspective where Solomon himself is a stranger to this kind of love. Let me show you how this works. Okay, we've already seen the woman's family's pretty messed up and she's been exploited by her own family. And I think Solomon tells us that right up front in 1 verses 5 and 6 to see that even though our world is a mess, even when we're dealing with ordinary people, people like us who don't necessarily live in the palace or have the army or are representatives to go and get wives or concubines, it is actually possible to find real love. Not easy, but it's not impossible. And it's worth pursuing. So as the relationship is described in chapters 1 and 2, Solomon seems to be urging us to hold out for the real thing, because this is an immensely attractive relationship. Now, who are these two? Okay, here's the way the book works. 1 verse 12. When the beloved, who's the woman, says that the king was at his table, you might think it's talking about Solomon. Is he your lover? Is she just saying her lover's like a king to me? We just don't know. Then we come to chapter 3, okay? And the girl starts dreaming. It's a bit of a strange dream in which the girl's running all over the city looking for her lover and failing to find him. Then she wakes up, and after the refrain of 3 verse 5, it seems that she dozes off again and has another dream. But this time, it's a little easier to tie down. 3 verse 6, this is what we read. Who is this coming up from the desert like a column of smoke perfumed with myrrh and incense made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it's Solomon's carriage escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with a sword at his side prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold, its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Jerusalem, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. Now, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to work out what this woman is dreaming about. She's dreaming about her wedding. And what's her wedding like in her dream? Well, it's a royal wedding. She dreams of her dream lover rocking up in Solomon's carriage to sweep her off her feet. Like countless little girls down through the ages, she imagines herself into the shoes of a fairy tale princess about to marry Prince Solomon Charming. So, who is this Solomon? Well, is it a description of his wedding to Pharaoh's daughter? That was wife number one, some people have suggested. Could be, but I don't think it is. Here's why. In the rest of the book, after this point, apart from the lover referring to the beloved as the prince's daughter, there is no suggestion that this is a society wedding. On the contrary, in the beloved's next dream in 578, as we've just seen, she is beaten up by the night watchman, which is an extremely unlikely scenario if she were Solomon's wife, if she were a princess. And then there's the climax of the book in 8 verse 11, which we've already seen, the bit about the vineyards where Solomon appears to get a knockback. So here's what I think's going on. The girl has a dream, like many girls, of her wedding. Having seen one of Solomon's weddings, and let's face it, there have been plenty of opportunity to see royal weddings in Israel, she imagines her wedding to be like this, where her Solomon shows up in his carriage to sweep her away. But actually, her Solomon, it turns out, has the face of her lover. He wears a crown in her dreams. He's a king in her eyes. But is it Solomon? Well, it's not totally clear yet. By the end of chapter 3, it could potentially still be Solomon. But our royal writer has a surprise to spring on us, which he holds back for a little while. And as we read on and find no more mention of the king showing up, gradually it dawns on us that actually this isn't King Solomon, that he has been passed over for this woman's real Solomon. So in chapter 5, the couple almost meet in her dreams, but for some reason in verse 6 it doesn't happen. She opened the door for her lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him, but did not find him. I called him, but he did not answer. Verse 8, O daughters of Jerusalem, this is all still in her dream, I charge you, if you find my lover, what will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love. Now, this isn't how it worked for Solomon. Basically, he clicked his fingers and presumably the wife who was on the rota was brought straight away. If he wanted to add someone to his harem, he sent the carriage around and usually that was that. But as he writes, it seems that Solomon realizes that out there in the real world, this isn't what happens. There's misunderstanding and longing and frustration and disappointment. And yet Solomon sees that this is the real thing. This kind of exclusive, yearning, full-blooded, passionate love. This would explain why in chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, Solomon has the lover point out that even all the queens, or numbers 1 to 60 at least, as well as the concubines, recognize that this relationship is in a different league. This is the real thing. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number. But my dove, my perfect one, is unique. The only daughter of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The maiden saw her and called her blessed. The queens and the concubines praised her. Now again, I wouldn't like to stake my life on this, but I think that, and I haven't read any better explanation of these numbers. Why should it be 60 queens and 80 concubines? Well, I think it's because the woman who rejected Solomon was number 61. And that later in his life he reflected on that. Make of that what you will. But I haven't found anybody else who can even make a punt at explaining why it's 60 and 80 at this point, other than it was actually at this stage that the incident happened. But what is clear is that as the song comes to an end, I think that as an older man, Solomon reflects on his own sexual conquests and the one that got away and realizes that he has missed out on the real thing. And so he's suggesting this is the kind of love that we really need to pursue, because this is the foundation of love that lasts and sex that is ultimately satisfying. Okay? Am I making that up? I don't think so. Just look again at chapter 8, from 8 verse 6. Find these words on the lips of the beloved. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like the flame of Yah, short for Yahweh. We'll come back to that in a minute. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. This is the kind of love we want for our children, for our little sisters. Verse 8, we have a young sister, and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. If she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. So we'll protect her from sexual predators, like Solomon, so that she's kept safe to enjoy this quality of love, because this is the only road to contentment. Verse 10, I am a wall and my breasts are like towers. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. Shalom. How can a man with 100 wives and pseudo wives say this? Because he knows that he has had lots of sex but no contentment. No shalom, no wholeness, no completeness, no satisfaction. Solomon, it seems, is the Bible's equivalent of Mick Jagger. If you wanted to compare this ultimate song to any other song, I think it would probably have to be Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. After all that he's been through, Solomon finally gets what's wrong. Sex is great, but only if it's the real thing. Only if it's in the context of romance, love, exclusive commitment, cherishing, selfless love. The Bible calls marriage. See, any other kind of relationship, of sexual relationships, not only inferior, it's damaging. See, Song of Songs may be the most erotic, explicit book in the Bible, but I think it's also the most passionately committed to safe sex, if you like, which in the context of the Bible is sex within the secure and self-giving context of marriage. And that is partly why we need this book today. I once came across a Christian couple who maintained that they were waiting to have sex until they were married. However, they were living in the same house on their own, just the two of them. They were sharing a room, and then they said actually they were sharing a bed. And they were appalled at the suggestion that they might be sleeping together. How dare anyone suggest such a thing, they actually said. Eventually I suggested that actually if they hadn't had sex after sharing a bed for months, then it was probably a good reason for them not to get married. Because when you read this book, these two lovers are so passionate that they are just radically committed to each other. Their relationship is moving in one direction. And it comes a point where really the only thing to do is to get married, which is effectively what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7. Okay. So what this book is saying is that, yes, sex is a gift from God and an immensely positive thing, even in our messed up world, but that there is a God-given context for it. So you have that. But the other thing that comes across very strongly in this book is that sex is not ultimate, which is also a great reason why we need to teach this book today. See, Solomon isn't just the Bible's sex therapist. What he actually does is warn us of the real danger of allowing our attitude to sex to wreck our lives. Essentially, he's warning us against idolatry, of making sex more important to us than God, of letting our libido win over our desire to obey. And it's really a terrible mistake. Okay. We need to teach this book to people today because we may not be the only generation that's ever been like this, but we certainly are a generation who live in an atmosphere where everything around us screams at us that sex is basically the best thing there is on offer. And if we're not having sex basically every night from the time we're 16, then there's something terribly sad about us. I don't know if it made the news here, but there was an unofficial, unauthorized autobiography or biography of American actor Warren Beatty just about 6 weeks ago, in which his biographer had alleged he'd had sex with 12,500 women, which basically worked out at an average of one every night for his whole adult life, with no allowance for holidays or illness or anything else. I mean, that's the world in which we live. And I mean, I don't know, I suspect that with the whole reporting of the Tiger Woods thing, that underlying all the condemnation, at points there was a tone which said, well, isn't this what every man would like? That's the world we live in. That's why we need to listen to this book. Because Solomon is saying this is not the be-all and end-all. That sex is not ultimate, but that God is. And that's partly why we have these intrusions of the real world into this kind of ideal relationship. And in that, if that is the message of the book, it fits perfectly with what Jesus says in the New Testament. Remember when the Sadducees ask him that really stupid question about the extremely unlucky woman who loses 7 consecutive husbands who just happened to be brothers before dying herself? And Jesus says, you're in error because you neither know the scriptures nor the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like angels in heaven. However good this is, it isn't ultimate. And I think Solomon realized that. Solomon realized that an intense human relationship, a husband-wife relationship, this sexual relationship, is the most dramatic, visible, tangible aid to grasping something else, something bigger, something ultimate. It's a great picture, but it is a picture. Which is why Solomon says what he says in 8 verse 6. Probably the most important statement in the book, but the English translations don't do us a lot of favors. They don't help us much in this. One of the quirks of Song of Songs is that in first glance, at least, it doesn't seem to mention God. Until you get to chapter 8, verse 6, which I think is the key which finally unlocks this tantalizing book. This is what it says. Place me like a seal on your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like the flame of Yah. And contrary to the NIV, Solomon almost certainly introduces the name Yahweh, the God of the covenant, the God of steadfast love at the climax of the book. And he does it to tell us how to make sense of all this. Now, because of Ephesians 5 in the New Testament, we're used to looking at our awesome God, Father, Son, and Spirit, to work out how we should relate as husbands and wives, amongst other things. But what Solomon is telling us that we actually need to look in the other direction. He's saying that human love at its best, committed, self-giving, exclusive, lifelong, passionate, marital love, if we look at that, what we will see is a pale reflection of the love of God. If you like, if this book is a ray of light, we need to look along the beam to the source of the light. Here's how C.S. Lewis explains this in an article called, appropriately, Meditation in a Tool Shed. I was standing today in the dark tool shed. The sun was shining outside, and through the crack at the top of the door there came a sunbeam. From where I stood, that beam of light with the specks of dust floating in it was the most striking thing in the place. Everything else was almost pitch black. I was seeing the beam, not seeing things by it. Then I moved so that the beam fell on my eyes. Instantly, the whole previous picture vanished. I saw no tool shed, and above all, no beam. Instead, I saw framed in the irregular cranny at the top of the door, green leaves moving on the branches of a tree outside, and beyond that, 90-odd million miles away, the sun. Looking along the beam and looking at the beam are very different experiences. Now, I think that's the way we need to read this book, Song of Songs. We need to read this book and see this marvelous relationship played out before us and say, yes, isn't love marvelous? Isn't sex marvelous in its proper context? But more than that, we need to look along the beam, to look along the light of this flame and say, well, yes, God is good. Because I think Solomon's message in this book, when he says that love is the flame of Yahweh, he is saying that actually God is ultimate, not sex. That God is the place we find our joy and security and significance through the Lord Jesus Christ. And I think Solomon realized that at the end of his pretty debauched life, I think that he came back to this central truth. And that's why he wrote this book. I don't think anyone has said this better than Jonathan Edwards, the American theologian, in a sermon he wrote in 1733. Here's what he said. God is the highest good of the reasonable creature, and the enjoyment of him is the only happiness with which our souls can be satisfied. To go to heaven to fully enjoy God is infinitely better than the most pleasant accommodations here. Fathers and mothers, husbands, wives, children, or the company of earthly friends are but shadows, but the enjoyment of God is the substance. These are but scattered beams, but God is the sun. These are but streams, but God is the fountain. These are but drops, but God is the ocean. Therefore, it becomes us to spend this life only as a journey towards heaven, as it becomes us to make the seeking of our highest end and proper good the whole work of our lives, to which we should subordinate all other concerns of our lives. Why should we labor for or set our hearts in anything else but that which is our proper end and true happiness, which is God himself? See, that I think is the message of this book. That Solomon realized that yes, human love at its best is spectacular. It's a gift from God. Yes, sexual love in the context of marriage is marvelous. But even the greatest gifts that God gives us are actually just pointers to something not just greater but ultimate, which is knowing God himself. I think that's the message of this book. And I think the challenge with Song of Songs is that we actually have to get there before we start. Because if we just jump in at chapter 1, verse 1, start to muddle our way through, we may not get there. Or if we get there, we'll get there too late, you know, and we'll have preached, you know, half a dozen strange sermons on the way. And I think that, if we're really honest, I mean, the number of people in the past 2 weeks who have said to me, I have never heard a sermon preached on the Song of Songs, has staggered me. In fact, Luke Tattersall, who's the chairman of the Men's Convention, said he checked. He said no one has ever spoken at Katoomba on the Song of Songs in 100-plus years of the convention's history. Right. I think I know why. But I think it's our failure to get to this big message, because once we've got that, then we have a context to go back and say, okay, how do we cope with the language? I mean, I think when it comes to teaching it, I think there are four issues that we've got to address. The first thing is, how do we cope with the language? Because all you have to do is read out this book And some people will find it funny. And some people will find it embarrassing. So let me teach this book, you've got to find a way to deal with that. Okay? Now, I don't know what your church is like, what your context is like. Personally, I think the key is finding a way to enable people to relax. So that it's okay to smile. You know, when the lover says to the beloved, you look like one of the horses pulling Pharaoh's chariot. In our culture, you know, it's very hard to read that out without people smiling. So you have to deal with that. The other thing is we do have to cope with the content. And I think this is tricky. I think there's some parts of this book that will cause raised eyebrows and possibly offense when we read it out. I mean, I'm not really sure that I would like to study Song of Songs in a small group with my father-in-law and mother-in-law, for example. Okay? And we have to be honest, we have to find a way to deal with that. And your context, you know, will be very, you know, maybe very different to mine. This is the first time I've been in Queensland. I have no idea what any of your churches are like. In our church in Dublin, we could read the whole book. You know, there'd be a few smiles and sharp intakes of breath. But in our culture, it wouldn't particularly be an issue. You've got to be the judges of whether that's appropriate. As to how you teach this to teenagers, best of luck. I have no idea. Okay? How do we handle sensitive issues? I do think whatever context we're teaching this book in, we just have to be aware that as soon as we open this book, we will raise hugely sensitive issues. Because the reality is, in any of our contexts, you know, there will be people who have sinned sexually, whose relationships are in a mess, in some cases are carrying around guilt from 20 or 30 years ago. They're grappling with issues they've not spoken to anybody about. And we do have to realize as soon as we go here that those things are going to be raised, and we need to be prepared for that in advance. Okay? And how do we break up the book? Be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I'm struggling to see how I could do this in any more than one go, for the simple reason that you've got to get to the end of the book to get to the bit that makes sense. Okay? Now, I think there are several important themes that come out. But my problem is, in our context, lots of people are only in church for 1 week. And I don't really want them to be there for a talk on, you know, how men and women should speak to each other. When I really want them to get to the bit where God is ultimate at the end of the book. That's really what I want to say to them. So I think that's a challenge. I think it is one of those books, a little bit like the book of Job, which really we need to read in one go. Phil, if you've got great suggestions, please do come up with that. Would be the direction in which I would go. To try to treat it in one. Because I think otherwise what you end up doing, I think Mark Driscoll, I mean, I watched most of them, I think he did 14 or 15 talks. And at one point, there's a little, I think it's chapter 2, verse 7, there's a verse about foxes. 2 verse 15. He's a catch for us, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. And Mark Driscoll used the immortal line, say, this is the kind of verse that preachers love because it gives us a hook to hang all the things we'd like to say on. He then spoke for an hour and 10 minutes about things that he'd like to say about marriage. Loads of really helpful things that had little or nothing to do with Song of Songs. And I think the problem is, if you break up Song of Songs too much, that's what you end up doing. Saying the things that are in your head rather than actually speaking from the text. But I'm happy to take advice from anyone else or listen to suggestions. If anybody's preached through it, love to hear how you did it. As I said, up to this point, I've only done one sermon in church on this and talks outside. Yeah?
I'll preach through Song of Solomon, so I'm not offering any advice. I'm asking you a question because you've done more work. How does the theme thing work? You know, preaching through, say, three sermons, picking up three themes. How does that go with what's it?
Well, you see, I think for me, you know, there are three kind of basic areas. There is the fabric of the conversation. You know, Solomon holds up this wonderful relationship. And I think there are things that we can learn from the way in which the lover and the beloved talk to each other. Solomon also kind of celebrates, you know, human sexuality, kind of marital love, if you like. And then Solomon also says, but hold on, this is not ultimate. There is more. This is a reflection of something else. You know, so you could cover those three areas. But, I mean, you know, my own conviction is that every time I speak, I want to point people to the gospel of the Lord Jesus. I want people to come out having been pointed to what God has done for us in Christ. And I'm not quite sure how you do that without doing violence to the text or having a talk in two halves, you know. Here's how men and women should relate to each other, and now let me tell you some things about Jesus, you know. But that's, yeah. Well, I mean, I think the answer is, you know, you get to chapter 8, and suddenly when you discover that this love is a picture of God's love, you know, we're launched on a trajectory, you know, which takes us very naturally to the great, you know, the ultimate display of God's love, which is in the Lord Jesus Christ on the cross. How do we understand the love of God? How did Solomon understand it? Not like that. But we know better than he did. We have seen. You know, we don't just have to look at human relations. I mean, Solomon could look at more than this, but we don't just have to look at human relationships at their best and extrapolate from that. We have actually seen the ultimate display of God's love. No, I mean that's basically, I think, how the book relates to the whole flow of the scriptures. But that's where I'm saying I am happy. I am happier doing that from the book of Song of Songs as a whole than trying to do it from individual. Yeah, there's something I've forgotten. Trying to do it from, you know, from individual statements in the book. I think Spurgeon once said something like, in the same way that there is a road from every town and hamlet in England to London, So there is a route from every part of the Old Testament to Christ. I think he qualified as saying, you know, you may have to jump across a few ditches and crawl through some hedges to get there. And if you've read any of Spurgeon's sermons, sometimes I suspect he spends quite a lot of time crawling through hedges, you know. But I think, you know, I am absolutely committed to getting to the gospel. Here's how I think of it. Okay, basically, the text of the Old Testament, if you imagine that we have a camera focused on an individual statement, okay? Sometimes we look at that statement and Christ is written all over it. You know, Isaiah 53, for the sake of argument. You know, you don't need to be a genius to see how Isaiah 53 relates to Jesus, okay? There are other parts of the Bible that what we need to do is just keep pulling back the camera. Sometimes we don't have to pull back very far to see how it fits into, you know, the whole picture, however that may be. With Song of Songs, personally, my feeling is that we need to pull back until we see the whole book. And suddenly when you see the whole book and you realize, Solomon is actually talking about human love at its best as a little spark of the kind of love that God shows, and then you go, that's how it fits in. So that would be how I would come at it. And I think is faithful to the flow of the book.
Genesis 3 talks about the consequences of the fall, so fundamentally three things. One is the separation from God. One is the thorns and the thistles and the fear of the beautiful and fierce. Mm-hmm. And one is this thing that happened between men and women. One of those things is the pain of pregnancy, childbirth, and one is this, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule you. And it's interesting to me that it would seem from reading tonight and what you said that it's not sexual desire that's part of that. That in fact we can be very happy that God has given us this gift between men and women as something that's pure and beautiful. within that committed relationship, and that's not something to fear, and in fact was part of the perfect creation. And that, you know, perhaps in Jesus' reconciliation and restoration back to what we were created for, that it's an affirmation that we don't need to read that Genesis section as being the woman's sexual desire as the reason for her subordination. And I actually find that quite comforting, that it's an affirmation of sexuality in all its wild abandon and joy between husband and wife, and it's not something to be afraid of, or something that we should all celebrate as we're able to. And to me, that's how it links into Jesus, that he has restored us back to what we lost.
Yeah, I think all I would add is that Solomon's also keen, all the way along, he's keen to say that this is taking place in a messy world, you know, and that, you know, we're from dysfunctional families and all our it isn't held up as a perfect relationship. You know, it's, I don't think he's trying to say that at all, but I think he's trying to say it's real and, you know, and to be valued and celebrated as a gift from God. Yeah.
I had some reference to historical stuff before, was in contact with Solomon. So just wondering how, if at all, you fit into his history of relating to God and sort of focusing on it as well. So it sort of almost seems like you're putting him now on an upward trajectory. How does that fit in, or do you not worry about it? I'm just wondering how it may not need to be. Do you fit in?
As I said, I wouldn't go to the stake for this. But I think the natural, it's in, when you read the commentaries, you keep finding this one statement. They say that it can't be written by Solomon because it's too critical of Solomon. And I just kept seeing the same statement recur all the time. So it's basically saying it can't be written by Solomon, and that possibility is that interpretation, which is the plain interpretation of the first line, Solomon's Song of Songs, it's excluded on the basis that Solomon couldn't have been self-critical. Which is just, to me, a very strange thing. Like, Solomon basically couldn't tell a story against himself. You know, whereas, for example, you go to Mark's Gospel, and if it's true that Peter's recollection is the source of Mark, Mark's Gospel is full of Peter's own self-critical recollection. My personal favorite is the Transfiguration, where Peter says, you know, put up the tents. And I mean, I don't think it's pushing it too far to say, to imagine Mark going, why did you suggest the tents? Peter says, it's the first thing came into my head. I didn't know what else to say. So Mark opens his brackets and says, he suggested about the tents because he didn't know what else to say. You know, when you look at the Gospels tradition, you know, what the Gospels say about the disciples, and I mean, that stuff came from them, it's extremely self-critical. Now, that may not settle the argument, but I think, you know, when you go to the commentaries, you really need to just put a line through that. And it's the same line that keeps recurring in all of them. They just keep repeating the same one. And I would just love to see somebody actually discuss that a little bit further. Okay? So, where would I put it? I think the nature of the book, it reads like a reflection back at the end of life, probably as an older man. If I had to guess, somewhere beyond where the story stops in First Kings, but
Gary, I get the question again now. I noticed Solomon occurs seven times in the book, the name. I was wondering if you'd comment. You then drew attention to contentment, that it's shalom.
Yeah.
And then you've got, if this couple that you think are probably, possibly don't even exist, and it's interesting that they call her a Shulamite. So you get that shalom.
Yeah.
Well. I was thinking, does that work? When you say the big idea, is the idea that this relationship brings contentment? Is that why there's such a play on Shulamite, Solomon, shalom?
It could be. I'm very happy with that. Yeah. I mean, I would just say I don't really have a firm opinion on whether they're real people or not. I'm just saying that in the context of the book, it doesn't actually. it doesn't require, the text doesn't tell us, no? I mean, I think it is based on a real encounter where Solomon is refused, and whether, you know, whether Solomon then describes the, this relationship that he has seen doesn't make any difference to me. But I think, you know, I think there is a play there in these names, this, that Solomon, whose name is derived from peace, is the one who doesn't find peace. But this girl brings peace to her lover. So I think it's helpful.
Just briefly, can I ask you preaching questions? You do it in one talk, but then how do you structure that talk? Do you go off, are you following the structure of the book itself? So, or is it amorphous?
I mean, I try to let the book shape the sermon, the shape of the passage determine the shape of the sermon. So I think, in at least part of it, I think what I would do is basically what I've tried to do tonight, to show that as it unfolds, it's almost like you have the veil pulled back over the players are identified as you go on. Okay? Now, whether I would try to go through the books three times, as sometimes, you know, you can do in a talk, could go through the passage three times and draw out separate things, or just do it in one, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a challenge because it's a long book. You know, and I've got two services, an hour and a half and 6 miles, or an hour and three quarters and 6 miles apart, you know, so that kind of constrains my own approach. If you've got unlimited time, so.